Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have with us today, once again, Professor Bradley Montan, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado Boulder. Professor Montan has been on our show a few times lately talking about his views as a philosopher of science who happens to also be an atheist, who happens to also be sympathetic towards the arguments of intelligent design, or at least thinks that they're worth taking very seriously. And Professor Montan recently did a debate in Fort Worth, Texas called The Great Debate, Intelligent Design and the Existence of God. It was held at the Will Rogers Auditorium in Fort Worth, Texas, and also at St. Andrew's Parish. And we have Professor Montan with us once again to talk about this debate and just kind of do a little debriefing and talk about how it went. So, Professor Montan, thanks again for coming on the show with us.
Thank you.
I want to first start off talking about something about this debate that I find extremely intriguing, maybe as a sign of things to come, more things to come in this debate, and that in this debate, the two scientists and academics and scholars who were upholding the pro-intelligent design and the existence of God side were non-theists, and the anti-ID side, and I guess the anti-God side, I'm not sure, were supposedly upheld by one scientist who is an atheist and another who is a theist. Is that a fair description of this debate that you did last week?
Well, there were two separate tracks of discussion. One was the does God exist or not track, and then the other is intelligent design plausible track. And so you had Lawrence Krauss, who's an atheist physicist, being against intelligent design. Then you had me, who's an atheist who's more sympathetic to intelligent design arguments. Then on the theist side, you had Dennis Alexander, who's a biologist, and he's basically a theistic evolutionist. And then David Berlinski, I mean, he was slated to represent the theistic pro-intelligent design position, but as probably a lot of your listeners know, Berlinski is more of a secular Jew agnostic who thinks at least that we should think that the issue of whether God exists is, you know, an open question, and maybe we should, you know, take seriously the idea that God exists, but he's not a definite theist. So it was interesting in the sense that different positions were being represented by different people, and almost all the positions on the table were sort of nuanced positions that you don't generally get when people portray the intelligent design debate as a war between two camps where one person has to be in one camp or the other. And most of the debaters were coming from more nuanced positions than that. So that was, I think, fascinating.
So what were some of your main arguments in the debate?
I spent a fair amount of time arguing for the idea that it's legitimate to treat intelligent design as science, and against methodological naturalism, the people who try to dismiss intelligent design just on philosophical grounds by saying that it's part of the on philosophy of science grounds, it's part of the methodology of science that it can't consider supernatural hypotheses. I also pointed out that intelligent design isn't inherently supernatural, that there are ways of that the intelligent design doctrine could come out true such that there still wouldn't be any supernatural beings. And I also raised some of the intelligent design, particular intelligent design arguments I think are interesting, or worth taking especially seriously, like the fine-tuning argument based on the fact that the values of the fundamental constants of physics are fine-tuned for life.
So it sounds like as a philosopher of science, your main goal coming into this debate was to argue that intelligent design should at the very least be on the table for taking seriously and shouldn't be, you know, dismissed out of hand as a non-scientific view. Is that a somewhat fair characterization of...
Yes, that's right. And then there were people like, well, Lawrence Krauss in particular tried to argue against that by, he brought in the whole wedge document issue, which I think confuses the issue of whether there's a cultural agenda behind intelligent design with what the doctrine of intelligent design actually is and what the arguments for intelligent design actually are. And then he tries to use standard arguments that lots of scientists use for what counts as science and what doesn't, like criteria of falsifiability and predictability and whether the theory generates experiments. Unfortunately, these criteria, I mean, we could go into the issues in detail if you wanted, but I almost think it's not worth it because if you start paying attention to the philosophy of science literature on demarcation issues nowadays, you'll see that these criteria, well, they were part of philosophy of science in the 1960s, but they've pretty much all been rejected by philosophers of science nowadays, with some notable exceptions. But most people don't take those criteria seriously anymore. But it seems like scientists kind of were raised, you know, when they went to school, they sort of learned 1960s philosophy of science and have stuck with that and, you know, their view of what counts as science and what doesn't. Berlinski and I were both trying to push Lawrence Krauss on that issue, but we didn't get very far.
But so Lawrence Krauss, he would basically say ID shouldn't even be taken seriously. It's not a scientific view. The alleged religious motives and beliefs and affiliations of its proponents disqualify it from being scientific. I mean, how does that argument go over when you've got two non-theists on the stage arguing that ID should be taken seriously?
Right. It's a good point. And Krauss didn't seem to acknowledge the point that he just made, but certainly it's a point that was in his face.
Yeah, I can imagine that doesn't get very far with the crowd, at least. Now, speaking of the crowd, there were some interesting reports about the debate online, one of which said that, Discovery Institute may have been, quote, footing the bill for the event, or that, quote, at the very least, they were paying the way for Berlinski and Montan, unquote. Professor Montan, did we pay your way for this to be in this debate?
Not that I know of. I mean, I got the money I got was from St. Andrew's Parish, which organized the whole debate. And I just have to mention, they organized it incredibly well. They did an amazingly good job, just from an organizational standpoint. And they got the money, they raised the money from donors, is what they told me.
Okay.
I didn't, you know, really care who the donors were. It doesn't matter. We were all told that we had free rein. We could say whatever we wanted. And even when we went to the church the next morning, we had basically a 3-hour session Friday night and then a 2-hour session Saturday morning. And the Saturday morning session, we were supposed to talk about, among other things, our views on the meaning of life. And so I, in church, looking at this huge stained glass window of Jesus, you know, I started out saying, okay, I'm going to tell you why I'm an atheist. And you know, the audience, I think, appreciated the irony and was open and receptive, and no one gave me a hard time. Everyone was infallibly nice and accommodating, and they told me that they appreciated my intellectual honesty.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. And I want our listeners to know that for those of you who may have been reading about these alternative accounts of the debate, I did some research, and the answer is that Discovery Institute had absolutely nothing to do with organizing this debate,
okay.
Nor did we provide any funding for it. And I wouldn't expect you to know that, Professor Montan, because you were just there and you participated. And this was put on, yes, as you said, by this church. And from what all accounts that I've been hearing, they did an excellent job. But the whole conspiracy theory that Discovery Institute is out there pulling all the strings. And you know, as Barbara Forrest said in Louisiana earlier this year, Discovery Institute is watching your every move. Well, we're not watching your every move. Matter of fact, you know, we think this is a really cool debate, and we actually get really excited when other folks get excited about ID and do great things like this on their own. As I said before, Discovery Institute certainly does not hold the copyright on intelligent design. You can't hold the copyright on a great idea. Ideas are way bigger than this, and we want to encourage any smart people out there who are going to support this view and do it in an intellectually honest, incredible way to do that, and we'll support them in spirit, or we'll just, you know, we'll do whatever we can. Now, there were a couple other things that these alternative accounts said, one of which it said that you argued during the debate that, quote, the current arguments used by ID advocates are awful and ineffective, unquote. Is that an accurate characterization of what you said during the debate?
No. I certainly don't recall saying that. If I did say that, it wasn't an accurate reflection of my views. I think what the author is referring to is a time where I made a conditional claim. I was trying to argue that intelligent design can count as science, and we shouldn't use the criterion of methodological naturalism to exclude intelligent design. And I think I made the conditional claim that even if the intelligent design arguments are ineffective in the way the author described, it doesn't follow that intelligent design isn't science or that methodological naturalism is true. Philosophers often have this problem that we will blithely make conditional claims, and then people will assume they'll forget about the if part of it and then just assume that we're asserting the then part. And, you know, I try to be careful in public context to make clear exactly what it is that I'm saying and not saying, but obviously sometimes people aren't following.
Well, I can appreciate maybe the confusion that this ID skeptic apparently had. I make a rule to never get in arguments with philosophers because they make very complicated, nuanced arguments that you really have to be tracking closely to refute them. And philosophers tend to be pretty smart people. Another interesting comment that this guy said is he called you the classic refrain idiot, of course. But he finally said that, quote, "The less said about Dr. Montan, the better. Quite frankly, I'm sure he's a nice fellow, but he had as much relevance to discussion as an expert in 17th century French poetry," unquote. The implication being, of course, that in the 17th century is when philosophers and scientists decided that the whole design hypothesis was not scientific, and that if you are maintaining that ID should be taken seriously, then you belong back in the 17th century. Now, the question is, who is out of date? Is it you, or is it or those who are claiming that philosophers of science would use criteria to rule ID out of science?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the people who are trying to implement these questionable demarcation criteria are the ones who are out of date. And more generally, the interesting thing about that move that the person you're talking about makes is, oh, the less said about Dr. Montan, the better. Actually, I think I gave lots of trenchant, you know, arguments that are worth serious consideration against, for example, Lawrence Krauss, who that author is on the side of. And so just saying, well, let's not talk about what Dr. Montan said, is, you know, kind of missing, you know, the crucial force of my argument.
I think that obviously this gentleman is experiencing some cognitive dissonance because you don't fit into his paradigm of the way the world is supposed to be. And so the less said about you, the better. I personally think we should say the more said about you, the better, but that's just my personal opinion.
Exactly. And this raises an interesting point. There was a group of people there at the debate who are from basically the local free thinkers group, you know, the atheist type group in Fort Worth in Dallas. None of them talk to me afterwards. There was a group of them talking to another speaker, and I actually walked up and listened for a while and sort of like made eye contact with a few of them, and they didn't say anything to me. And you would have thought they would have been intrigued to like talk with me, but no.
Very interesting. Well, maybe to them you're an apostate. I'm not sure. Just by being there participating. I mean, I've had many experiences with folks involved with these skeptic societies and these atheist groups. And by and large, actually, they're really nice people. I've had some wonderful experiences interacting with these kind of folks. And, you know, actually have built some really neat friendships over the years having these kinds of experiences. And I'm sure that you certainly have no problem interacting with folks from these skeptics groups and so forth.
Right.
So it's too bad they didn't want to talk to you. Maybe the less said about you, the better. They were trying to live by that rule. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the debate? It sounds like it was a very interesting afternoon and then the next morning as well.
Yeah, it was. There are other interesting issues that came up. The interesting thing about Dennis Alexander is that he's not a deist. He doesn't think that God set up the world and then just let it go into motion. He thinks that God continuously is active in the world. And you might think that that's very conducive to the intelligent design line of thinking about biology. But he tried to portray intelligent design as a God of the gaps argument, that basically most of biology works fine via standard naturalistic evolutionary processes. But occasionally, for things like the bacterial flagellum or for blood clotting, God comes in and plays a role. And he thought that, you know, he had problems with that line of reasoning. I tried to argue with him and suggest that intelligent design isn't even running a God-to-gaps type argument at all. And the one way to make that point would be to say that, and maybe this isn't true for all intelligent design proponents, but I could see some intelligent design proponents saying that God does constantly play a role in the world and is constantly involved in evolutionary processes, but it's only sometimes that we can get good evidence that God is involved in those evolutionary processes. So the issue isn't that God is sometimes intervening in the world. God's always intervening. The only question is, when can we get evidence for God's intervening? And then the bacterial flagellum and blood clotting examples would be examples where the intelligent design proponents would say it's pretty clear that we are getting evidence.
I think that's a very good point. And I think that one of the main arguments of ID is that this is not about having a theological doctrine of creation that says that this is, you know, an overall scheme of how God interacts with the world. It's about detecting design when we can detect it. And as far as theology goes, I mean, ID proponents very well may have theological views that say that God is always interacting with the world, and sometimes in ways that we can detect, and sometimes in ways that we cannot. But as far as, you know, the science of ID goes, I think you make a good good point. We're not going to try to claim that there's some intelligent agent behind everything, whether it's detectable or not. That's not what the science of ID is going to claim. It's going to claim that we detect design when we can detect design. And This is not about having some overarching theological doctrine of creation or how God interacts with the world. I mean, that's fine if you want to do that, but that's theology and that's not ID. The idea is a very different project. So yeah, I think you make some very good points there. I'm going to finish this up with just a short little sound off of myself. You might call this Casey's thoughts, analogous to Jerry Springer's thoughts on the Jerry Springer Show that he always ends his show with. And that is this gentleman who critiqued the debate, saying that this was basically all just a conspiracy by Discovery Institute, who was paying for all of it and paying people to say certain things. And this is all just people at the high levels pulling the strings, paying people to say certain things. The problem with conspiracy theories, and this goes for any kind of conspiracy theory, is that they almost always assume that the average person is not behaving as a rational agent, that they're always the pawn of some higher force, or that they don't have actual minds and intelligences themselves that they're using and exercising to come up with their own viewpoints, and they're always the pawn of some higher level unseen force. That's really a travesty of a position to hold when you're dealing with intellectual debates where people clearly do have their own intellectual positions, such as Professor Montan or Berlinski. And the whole notion that people just say things because they're being paid to say things, these kind of conspiracy theories don't fit with the reality that people are rational agents that have their own views, and they make up their own minds and make their own arguments. We see these kind of conspiracy theories a lot in this debate, the idea that Discovery Institute is watching every move and we're pulling every string. I mean, we laugh at these kind of things here, because if we were a tenth of it as influential as our critics thought we were, gosh, who knows what we could accomplish. But the bottom line is that there are people out there in the real world, whether our critics like it or not, who independently think ID is a really good idea and think that academic freedom should be protected and think that philosophy of science should not be ruling out ideas a priori and think that there is empirical evidence for ID in nature that deserves to be published in scientific journals. This is not a conspiracy on the part of Discovery Institute. This is the power of an idea, and there are a lot of rational agents out there, intelligent people, who have independently come up with these views. And I think that when our critics used conspiracy theories to try to, you know, just claim this is all a conspiracy of Discovery Institute, they're only going to get very far with folks who already have some kind of bizarre obsession with attacking Discovery Institute as it is. Anyway, that's Casey's thoughts for the day. And Professor Montan, we appreciate your time and the time you spent doing this debate and being on our show today.
Thanks, Casey. And yes, regarding your thoughts, I just want to reiterate that I'm not a pawn of anyone saying what I think, and that's what I've been doing as a philosopher for many years, and just recently I've gotten interested in the intelligence design debate, and there's nothing special or different about the way I'm treating the intelligence design debate than the way I've treated any other intellectual issue I've gotten involved in.
Well, we wish you the best, regardless of what direction you go in the debate, that you will just have academic freedom to continue to produce and explore your views, Professor Montan.
Thanks, Casey.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast, signing off. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.